On tenor sax and an orchestra of great jazz notables with Percy Mayfield's River's Invitation, arrangement by Oliver Nelson. This is from Turrentine's 1965 studio album, Joyride. This is Lead Stories. I'm your Trace Lead. And today, a packed program. We're going to go historical, not hysterical, but historical today. Our guest is the one, the only, the incomparable, Gerald Horn. Radical historian and political scientist Dr. Gerald Horn brings his unique perspective to several contemporary issues around the world. Horn holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. A prolific author, he has written close to 40 books and more than 100 scholarly papers on struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. His most recent works include, and the titles are quite instructive, Paul Robeson, The Artist is Revolutionary, The Rise and Fall of the Associated Negro Press, Claude Barnett's Pan-African News and the Jim Crow Paradox, Storming the Heavens, African Americans and the Early Struggle for the Right to Fly, Facing the Rising Sun, African Americans, Japan, and the Rise of Afro-Asian Solidarity, and The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean. So I welcome you once more. It's great to have you with us, Gerald.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
I see you haven't been doing very much with your time.
Oh, I see. Actually, I've been, I hope this is not an insult. I've been busy as a one-arm paper hanger.
As a one-arm paper hanger in a windstorm. So
exactly.
Tell us what's coming next. I always ask you this at the top so that we don't run out of time before you are able to tell us.
Well, in the next few months, I'm going to publish this very lengthy book, the longest thing I've ever written, on U.S. imperialism in Southern Africa from the late 19th century up to 1994. And, of course, South Africa is the centerpiece, but it's also dealing with Namibia, Angola, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, etc. And I'm writing, and I've written about half of the manuscript, a book on racism and the political economy of the music we call jazz, which, given what you've been playing on these, on this channel, you, might be something of interest to you. It goes from the late 19th century up until, I guess, about the 1970s and 1980s. And right now I'm working on a book on boxing. Yeah, actually, in my music book, I had said that the most exploited black people in the United States were musicians. But now that I'm working on this book on boxing, I'm going to have to revise that and say it's the boxers. And I'm dealing primarily with racism and organized crime in the boxing industry. Then I'm working on a book on black Washington, D.C. I'm trying to figure out this paradox. How did this white supremacist state, the United States, somehow manage to have a capital city, Washington, D.C., that for a good number of years has been mostly black, although I guess they are asking themselves the same thing, that is to say the elites of Washington. And so gentrification is proceeding apace in Washington, D.C., as the black people are being forced out. And then I'm working on this book on the 1500s. It's sort of the precursor to the Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism book that you so kindly mentioned in my book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776. It's dealing with the rise of the European settler invasion of the Americas in the 1500s, post-1492.
Wow. That's quite a tall order that you have there, but that's the pace at which you work, actually. It's nothing unusual where you are concerned. You just go at it. And next thing you know, we have four or five new books. So I hope that we'll be able to discuss these books very soon.
Oh, inevitably, undoubtedly.
Well, let's start with the president of the United States and his abysmal performance at the NATO summit. And he's now in Britain, and I think they're gearing up to give him a very warm welcome over there. What do you make of Donald Trump's performance at the NATO summit?
Well, I agree with the recently defrocked British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson when he suggests there is method in the madness of Donald J. Trump. That is to say, when he is hammering the so-called NATO allies about not spending more, he's basically seeking to direct contracts towards Lockheed Martin and other charter members of the United States military-industrial complex. That is to say that European governments have spent more of their tax dollars on U.S. fighter jets with the profits going to the stockholders of Lockheed Martin. When he hammers Germany for its energy deals with Russia, he's seeking to get Germany to redirect those energy contracts to Texas oil men and Texas natural gas producers and Louisiana natural gas producers. So I have to say I'm disappointed in the performance of the so-called anti-Trump press, New York Times, Washington Post, MSNBC, because this is obvious, but they've hardly mentioned it, although they've been denouncing Trump for disrupting the allies. And by the way, I was listening to an NPR show, 1A, I'll mention names, and it had a program on NATO, and it had the temerity not to bring on a guest who was critical of NATO. All the guests were part of the so-called anti-Trump resistance, and they're all pro-NATO. And it seems to me that's deeply problematic and troublesome. And there's another point, too, with regard to this so-called anti-Trump press, which is why we need programs like yours, by the way, which is that I think that when you penetrate the bluster and the bloviating, it's easy to see that Trump is trying to execute a new grand strategy to preserve the hegemony and dominance of U.S. imperialism. The Democrats, of course, were pursuing the old-time religion, and the anti-Trump resistance or denouncing Trump are pursuing the old-time religion. That is to say, uniting with the European Union and Canada and NATO to confront Russia and China. I mean, that's been the line for years now. Mr. Trump is seeking, it seems to me, to turn Canada into a kind of puppet state, a vassal state. And by the way, that may not be that difficult. Canada is quite vulnerable. It only has a population 10% of that of the United States. The economy is heavily dependent on the United States. It's having difficulty in reacting to this new circumstance, which is complicated by the fact that, like the United States, Canada has a substantial Eastern European hardcore anti-communist population, as exhibited by the person in charge of Canadian foreign policy, Chrystia Freeland. And so, therefore, it has really nowhere to go because it can't cut a deal with Russia because of the being hamstrung by that domestic constituency that I've just mentioned. And so here you had the spectacle of Justin Trudeau just before the NATO summit. Where does he go? To Latvia, a country of about 2 million that has very complicated relations with Moscow. So Canada is quite vulnerable. Mr. Trump is obviously trying to split the European Union. There is an offer to France fundamentally to leave the European Union, according to The Guardian of London, which France has rejected, quite understandably. He's obviously has a bone to pick with Germany and never misses an opportunity to criticize Germany quite sharply, which, of course, came up during the NATO summit. And the idea is that with those states in his pocket, he'll then seek, as the meeting with Putin will suggest, seek to neutralize Putin by, A, playing a double game, that is to say, continuing the Democratic Party line of supporting what amounts to neo-fascists in Ukraine to tie down Moscow, and, B, trying to give sweeteners to Moscow to turn on both China and Iran, which I don't think will work, but that's part of the strategy. Because the big enchilada is China. That's why you have this trade war with China now in the hundreds of billions of dollars. Never let it be said that Utrecht Leeds programs don't give out stock tips, because even though China may not be able to match the United States tit for tat in terms of tariffs, it can harass the U.S. corporations that are heavily exposed in China. I'm speaking of Apple, Microsoft, KFC, GM, and particularly Starbucks, which also has a founder, Howard Schultz, who's been touted as a potential Democratic nominee for president. So they're really going to get it from all sides, not only from China, but from the United States as well. And it's that's really the name of the game. And the whole question of these tariffs, it's difficult to resolve that question because the goalposts keep moving. At first, we had thought that Mr. Trump wanted China to buy more U.S. goods, but a good deal of the U.S. ruling elite says, no, that's not the problem. It's a structural problem. They're terrified and petrified by this Made in China 2025 program, which foresees China as the world leader in robotization, green energy, quantum computing, and all the rest, all the cutting-edge new technologies, which will make for a new world order, soaring far beyond what George H.W. Bush talked about in the early 1990s. And I would ordinarily say that China can absorb more pain than the United States in fighting this trade war. And I will not disagree with anybody who makes that contention. However, some of the recent news out of China may give one pause. I mean, for example, military veterans of the People's Liberation Army have been engaged in protests in recent weeks at the offices of the military, Central Military Commission, which President Xi Jinping heads. Of course, he's also head of the Communist Party and president of China, but being head of the Central Military Commission could be seen as equally important, if not more important, than those other two posts. And it's quite disturbing from Beijing's point of view that these military veterans have been protesting for various reasons. They feel sort of left out of this turbocharged Chinese economy. And second of all, there's the nationalities question, the minority question, particularly in Western China, where you have a substantial Muslim population. As you know, U.S. imperialism, as Afghanistan shows, is not above aligning with the religious zealots. And certainly their Saudi allies are not above that either, particularly since they're religious zealots themselves. And they could create significant difficulty for China. But still, at the end of the day, it's going to be very difficult for the United States to reverse the way the tides of history are going, which seem to be heading in China's direction, which will cast new doubt upon what is oftentimes seen as a stroke of genius. I'm speaking of Richard Nixon's trip to Beijing some 45-odd years ago, where he effectuated this anti-Soviet entente with Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai and Chinese leadership, and that put enormous pressure on the Soviet Union, helping to engineer the Soviet collapse by 1991. That is seen as the crown jewel in terms of U.S. foreign policy. But in some ways, Uncle Sam might be like the man who jumps out of the Empire State Building and, when passing the 45th floor, says, "So far, so good." Because quite frankly, I think that that deal with China ultimately will be seen as not so good a deal at all, particularly since the payoff for China was in direct foreign investment from U.S. corporations, which has created this juggernaut that is now in the passing lane and has caused Mr. Trump to try to execute a new grand strategy that is alienating his so-called allies, most notably.
Now, how is it that you see these things so deeply when I stop at the fact that, you know, Trump is, first of all, unstable. I think he's an unstable man. And I think he is literally under the direct instruction of people who see the world totally in terms of what's good for them. And not necessarily in the short term. They don't have the capacity to think long term. Their thing is, as long as he's in office, and everybody has their fingers crossed, at least in that world, that he would, you know, be in office for at least another term. But the race is on to get as much out of this administration in terms of money and contacts and business arrangements that yield more money, that they are trying to just make haste to put their hands on lucrative deals. And so, you know, they put up with Trump. Trump is the guy that would take the lead role in facilitating that.
Well, I don't necessarily disagree with that. As a matter of fact, if I were a U.S. attorney, and of course, theoretically, they're under the aegis of Rod Rosenstein and Jeff Sessions in the Justice Department. But still, I would have to suspect that there might be insider trading going on with regard to Donald Trump Jr. and Eric Trump and Mr. Trump himself and Jared Kushner, the son-in-law. That is to say that Mr. Trump is passing on information gleaned from intelligence reports or whatever. For example, I just gave stock tips with regard to the fortunes of Apple and Starbucks, and et cetera. Well, Mr. Trump, he's the one who's pulling the strings, so he's the one who can effectuate those conditions that can cause these stocks to drop. And then Mr. Trump Jr. or Eric can then either sell or buy based upon what their father says. So I think there's something to what you say, just like I think there's something to those who pursue this Russiagate line. That is to say, I do think that you should follow the money with regard to, for example, the Trump organization selling condos at inflated prices to Russian oligarchs, and that becomes a form of money laundering. But still, I think that at the end of the day, one has to look at the objective impact of what Mr. Trump is doing and then reason back from that. And I think that the United States does face a real crisis. U.S. imperialism faces a real crisis with regard to the rise of China. And even Mr. Obama tried to do a reset with Russia and a pivot towards Asia, meaning a pivot towards China. And in some ways, Mr. Trump is only executing a policy that was sketched by the 44th U.S. president, Mr. Obama. And so when you see that the U.S. Pacific Command...
44th.
Sorry?
No, the 44th.
Yes. When you see that the U.S. Pacific Command is renamed the Indo-Pacific Command, that is to say, trying to enlist India in this anti-China cabal, well, that's nothing new. Mr. Obama was trying to do the same thing. So I think that the progressive movement and the so-called anti-Trump resistance would be better served if it tried to analyze these events more carefully and more deeply than they have done to this point.
What are we missing about the current crisis between the United States and Mexico over immigration and related issues, including trade? Historically, what should we, where should we place the locus of where this whole thing began, and therefore we can see today's developments in that light?
Well, I agree with those who say that the recent election of Mr. López Obrador is a political earthquake. It portends a seismic shift in this hemisphere, in particular in Latin America. AMLO, as he's called, also suggests that this is the fourth great development in the history of Mexico. Development number one being the struggle against Spanish colonialism between 1810, circa 1821, which then leads, as you know, to the election of President Vicente Guerrero of African descent 180 years before the election of Barack Hussein Obama. And then Mexico tries to carry out a policy abolishing slavery, which outrages the Anglo settlers led by Stephen F. Austin and Sam Houston, who they had attracted to what was then northern Mexico, because the Mexican government was very upset with the policies of the indigenous population in that region, particularly the people we refer to as the Comanches, which led to the fateful decision to attract these Anglo settlers, as they were called, who then got upset with the abolition of slavery and then seceded from Mexico in 1836, just like George Washington, Thomas Jefferson and company had seceded from the British Empire in 1776, precisely on this question of enslavement of Africans. So you had the North American or the U.S. counter-revolution of 1776, and then the Texas counter-revolution of 1836, which then leads directly to a war between the United States and Mexico, where the United States seizes a great deal of Mexican territory, including California. It's quite striking that the three largest states in the current United States of America, California and Texas and Florida, two of those three, California and Texas, were seized from Mexico. And then the third, Florida, of course, seized from Spain, circa 1820, 1821. The second development, according to AMLO, was the Mexican Revolution, 1910 to 1920, which for our purposes here features the activities of the first black heavyweight, or, well, I shouldn't say the first, the black heavyweight boxing champion Jack Johnson from Galveston, Texas, who came under fire because of his dating habits, which ventured across the racial barrier, and then was convicted and fled to Mexico, where he tried to establish a base in Mexico City to from which he could launch a campaign in the United States against lynching and oppression of black people and all the rest before having to come back to the United States circa 1920, where he was then arrested and jailed. The third development being the election in the late 1930s of President Cárdenas, who nationalized the oil industry. And the fourth, and that, of course, led to another stream of black American migrants, including Elizabeth Catlett, probably our leading sculptress, who migrated to Mexico. Marvin X, the black arts figure of Oakland, he was amongst the black Americans who fled to Mexico seeking to escape being drafted. Not everybody fled to Canada. Some fled to Mexico. And we should keep that in mind, Mexico as being a sanctuary for political dissidents from this side of the border as the noose tightens around our neck here in the United States of America. And then the fourth development being what happened on July 1st, 2018, with the election of AMLO, a man of the left. This bids fair to lead to tighten relations with China by the New Mexico City government when it takes power on December 1st, tighten relations with the European Union, which obviously is going to be scrambling for partners because of the erratic nature of U.S. imperialism under Donald J. Trump. Obviously, tighten relations with Cuba and with a hopefully progressive Brazil, depending on what happens with these elections that take place this fall, and they don't look very good right now. And, of course, good relations with Bolivia under Evo Morales. So this election in Mexico is potentially a game changer. And I might also say that a point of personal privilege, if our black leadership was more up to speed, they would be organizing delegations that would include led by the Congressional Black Caucus to meet with their counterparts in Mexico City, because obviously the clouds are becoming much more ominous with every passing day in the United States of America. That is to say the progressive community, and I would say the black community in particular, we're like the frog that's dipped into hot water and then the temperature keeps rising. And before we know it, we're dinner unless we hop out of the water. And the temperature is rising, and there's not enough sense to hop out of the water. And it's sad and tragic that many of our leading black politicians, black intellectuals, they're not keeping up with global developments, which reduces them to tacticians, sort of reacting to this and that move by the Republicans in Washington and Mr. Trump's tweet storm, but not being able to develop a larger, wider strategy, because in order to do that, you'd have to know what the major trends are globally, which somehow has escaped them.
How would that assist how would that be of benefit to blacks, not just in the United States, but in the region, in the Caribbean especially?
Well, I should have mentioned in my previous remarks that CARICOM, the Caribbean community, Jamaica, Barbados, Trinidad, will also be a beneficiary of this new election in Mexico. For example, I expect there to be a renationalization of energy. Keep in mind that when Hugo Chavez, and followed by Maduro, came to power in Caracas, they began to effectuate preferential deals for oil and petroleum with regard to many of the CARICOM nations, particularly Haiti, by the way. Oil is now rising. It's up to about $70 a barrel. It may not hit 140 like it did a few years ago. But if Mexico renationalizes the oil, then it will have a partner with Venezuela, hopefully in providing subsidized oil to the CARICOM nations. Now, you know, our friends in Kingston and Port of Spain and Bridgetown, they don't have to be told this, because to a degree, I guess I'm being somewhat unfair to the black American leadership, because these Caribbean nations, they have sovereignty. They have diplomats on the ground in Mexico City who are filing reports on a regular basis, and they are quick to seize upon these kinds of trends and developments. Now, we, of course, have access to the Internet, so there's no excuse for not being able to keep up with global developments. But I think with regard to the black American leadership, the question is, how do you put political pressure on the Trump team? How do you work with the United Nations with regard to its various investigations of the human rights situation in the United States and the poverty situation in the United States, the police terror situation in the United States, with the United Nations teams basically coming here and saying the United States should pay reparations to the descendants of enslaved Africans as a matter of equity and justice? How do you leverage that kind of influence, particularly when we know that historically that the way black people have been able to make an advance in this white supremacist society, a society, by the way, as I mentioned a few moments ago, that came into being on an anti-abolition of slavery platform, which means that black people are still seen as public enemy number one. There's no accident with regard to these hashtags, breathing while black, living while black, Pool Patrol Paulo calls the police on a black youth that goes into a public Pool or Barbecue Becky, who in Oakland calls the police or the black people who try to have a barbecue at a public park. I mean, these are not coincidences. What's remarkable about the United States is that there's a lot of denunciation of what are called conspiracy theorists in the United States. But basically, this country is full of coincidence theorists. Everything is a coincidence. I mean, what's happening to black people? It's all a coincidence. It doesn't have a common taproot. That doesn't have a history. And what I'm trying to suggest to you is that this kind of persecution and oppression stems and flows organically from the way the country was formed, or the way our past organizations and leadership were able to countervail that dastardly trend, was by lengthening the battlefield and by inviting the international community to intervene in the U.S. domestic situation. But since 1954, with Brown versus Board of Education, where our leadership made a bet that the courts would be the savior and the guarantor of our rights, a vow that has been under assault for decades, and now it's reaching a crescendo with the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court, which I'm afraid to say will finally put paid to that lunatic idea that the courts could be a guarantor of rights of a disfavored minority. And you would think that with this turning point, this fork in the road that we have now reached with the nomination of Mr. Kavanaugh, who, of course, I'm opposed to, but if you back me into a corner and force me to make a determination, I would have to say that given the fact that Joe Manchin of West Virginia, a Democrat, voted for Neil Gorsuch, and Joe Donnelly of Indiana, a Democrat, voted for Neil Gorsuch, and Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota, that all of them will vote for Mr. Kavanaugh, which means that he will take the Anthony Kennedy seat, which would then lead to a slow and steady erosion of whatever advances have been made over the last few decades, which obviously cries out for a new strategy. But I'm afraid to say that many of our organizations and leaders, they only know what they have been doing for the last few decades. They have engaged in what the 9/11 Commission called a failure of imagination. And when you're a disfavored minority that engages in a failure of imagination, you're in deeper doo-doo than you might even think.
Could you allow us to go to the African continent for a moment and take a look at three specific areas, Yemen, Ethiopia, and Eritrea?
Mm-hmm.
Could you give us an overview from your perspective as to why we need to pay attention, not just to these areas, but there's a reason that they have come under particular focus for the moment, but the continent as a whole. But what is particularly significant about Eritrea and Ethiopia and Yemen?
Well, first of all, an introductory remark. The peace overtures between Eritrea and Ethiopia are quite profound and significant. Those looking for good news out of Africa need look no further than the peace overtures between Eritrea and Ethiopia. And I'll get back to that in a second. But also on the question of good news, President Cyril Ramaphosa of South Africa is now visiting Nigeria. South Africa has become the latest state to sign on to the African Continental Free Trade Agreement. We're waiting for Nigeria to do so. We expect that to take place within months. As Mr. Ramaphosa said, and it's no secret, obviously this will benefit the South African economy. It'll benefit in the sense that if you go to Nigeria now, you see significant penetration by South African business. And of course, sadly and unfortunately, you don't see a similar penetration of Nigerian business and enterprise in South Africa. In fact, you've had xenophobic attacks against Nigerians, including, I'm afraid to say, as a direct result of one of Hollywood's most despicable projects, that movie District 9, which was a science fiction movie that portrayed Nigerians and South Africa as monsters. Not the Afrikaners, you know, not the British, but Nigerians. I mean, it's a loony's idea. It's Looney Tunes. But in any case, that's good news because this free trade agreement will help to knit these African nations together as an economic unit, which then brings us back to the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia, Eritrea. I think that if you look at Ethiopia in particular, Ethiopian Airways, which, by the way, was initiated by black Americans. I talk about it in the book you mentioned, Storming the Heavens, who migrated there in the 1930s to help Ethiopia repel fascist Italy during its invasion of the 1930s. And John Robinson of Gulfport, Mississippi, via Chicago, became the personal pilot of his Imperial Majesty Haile Selassie, overthrown, as you know, in 1974, and then helped to form Ethiopian Airways, which is now one of the leading carriers on planet Earth, and in fact is certainly a Pan-African airway. That is to say that increasingly, if you want to fly from Nigeria across the continent to Addis Ababa, you can fly Ethiopian Airways. And that brings us to the fact that Eritrea, which had formerly been part of Ethiopia but fought a war to secede from Ethiopia, which was successful. Ethiopia has a population of about 100 million. Eritrea is about 5 million. And I think that if, once again, if our black American intellectuals and leaders were up to speed, they would study very carefully how Eritrea, which is 1/20th the size of Ethiopia, kept Ethiopia off balance for decades. Now, you know, look, I'm no fan of President Isaias and Asmara in Eritrea. I mean, you have Eritrean young men fleeing all over the world. I mean, many of these migrants crossing the Mediterranean from Libya as we speak, trying to get into Europe or Eritrea. Many of the migrants trying to get papers in Israel or Eritrea. They're trying to escape the military draft. But just looking at how he has kept Ethiopia off balance through diplomacy, and of course I don't approve of all the diplomatic moves, but let me just explain them and you'll understand why I don't approve of them. That is to say, making alliances with Saudi Arabia against Addis Ababa, with the United Arab Emirates against Addis Ababa, with Cairo, with Egypt. Of course, there have been tense relations between Egypt and Ethiopia going back centuries. And in fact, the latest crisis has to do with Ethiopia trying to build a dam that Cairo claims will challenge its lifeblood, which is the Nile River. And in fact, you might recall that just a few years ago, there was a high-level meeting in Cairo where leaders of the Egyptian state were caught on tape talking about destabilizing the Ethiopian government. And so Eritrea has been able to play a very adroit diplomatic game, which has driven the new Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, only 41 years old, to the negotiating table. He was just in Eritrea a few days ago. There will be telephone links reestablished, air links reestablished. Ethiopia will be able to use Eritrea's ports in order to export its goods. And, of course, Ethiopia has had some of the highest growth rates, not only in Africa, but in the world. There's a significant Chinese investment in Ethiopia. And, in fact, part of what's happening now is that a number, as Chinese wages rise, you have Chinese manufacturers seeking lower wages, quite frankly, in Ethiopia. And this is helping to create an Ethiopian working class, which inevitably will organize and will inevitably seek to improve working conditions and wages across the board. So I think that this move that you just suggested between Ethiopia and Eritrea is highly significant. Hopefully it will also have impact across the Red Sea in Yemen, which is under siege by the Saudis, who, from their point of view, they see themselves as waging a proxy war against the folks they call the Houthis, who they say are tied to Iran and Saudi Arabia or Iran or in the midst of a Cold War. And I might also say that Saudi Arabia also has a de facto relationship with Israel. And you should also try to track what Israel has been doing in the heart, in the Horn of Africa as well, if you're trying to understand this recent move between Eritrea and Ethiopia. But in any case, what's happening now in Yemen is a human rights catastrophe. U.S. imperialism, of course, is backing its Saudi allies in this Yemen war. Every few minutes, a Yemeni child dies because of either famine or warfare. Although if you look at the U.S. press, you think the major problem are alleged missiles flying into Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, launched allegedly by the folks they call the Houthis. It's unclear where the struggle in Yemen will end up, although those of us with long enough memories recall that it was not so long ago, just a few decades back, that there was a People's Democratic Republic of Yemen under a left-wing government that then, like the left-wing government in Afghanistan or the left-wing government in Grenada or the left-wing government, you name the country, came under assault by U.S. imperialism, forced to retreat. And what has happened is the inevitable. That is to say, this disintegration of the state, the rise of religious zealotry, the rise of war. But on a more positive note, once again, these developments across the Red Sea and Eritrea and Ethiopia is a breath of fresh air that we should all be celebrating.
Well, let's come back home here for a minute and talk about ideology. Is there an ideological crisis in America at the moment that prevents us from being really clear about what our options are, who is who, what is what, and where we ought to be going? How do we navigate a system that we seem not to really have a good handle on?
Well, clearly there is, and you can even pinpoint when it happens. I mean, just to revert to what I was saying about the Supreme Court nomination of Brett Kavanaugh, here you have the American Civil Liberties Union, which has raised all this money, it's developing a political arm, but I don't think it's dealt fairly with its own history. That is to say that it purged its left, like many organizations were forced to do, or maybe not forced, but they willingly did. I'm speaking of one of its stalwarts, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, now in no longer the land of the living. Just like the NAACP, another player with regard to this Brett Kavanaugh fight, they purged their left too, starting with its founder, W.E.B. Du Bois, or the AFL-CIO, which purged its left, not least Harry Bridges, well-born in Melbourne, Australia, who migrates to San Francisco and leads the San Francisco General Strike of 1934, Lee's informs the International Longshore and Warehouseman Union, a pioneer with regard to fighting racism in the working class, one of the reasons why the AFL-CIO purged him. Of course, he was accused of being a communist, like these other two figures that I've mentioned. But therein, you begin to see this ideological crisis, because, you know, it's quite interesting now, if you step back for a moment. So you have all of these groups, and including, you know, the directive, the edict came down. You need to purge all these folks on the left because they're too close to Moscow. Okay, fine. So everybody goes along with the program. Now, the right wing, which was behind that purge, they're being accused of backing a president, Donald J. Trump, who was accused of being close to Moscow. And the right wing says, you know, so what? And, of course, the liberals feel betrayed because you said, you know, we purged people who are close to Moscow. Why don't you? And, you know, the right wing says, you know, tough cookies. You know, you shouldn't have gone for the okey-doke. And so therein you begin to see the seeds of this ideological crisis, because it's not just sort of whether or not someone was close to Moscow or not. It's whether someone had a worldview or not. I just saw a very interesting documentary about Jack O'Dell, who may be familiar to some of your listeners. He's in self-imposed exile in Vancouver, British Columbia. And he was a former top aide to Martin Luther King, and in some ways, and also was a top aide to Jesse Jackson when he ran for president. And so, Jack, you might recall that in the early 1960s, JFK, U.S. President, took Martin Luther King into the Rose Garden to escape the eavesdropping of the FBI to tell MLK that he needs to get rid of Jack. And, of course, MLK complies, and he tries to have this subterranean relationship with Jack, but the FBI picks it up on the wiretaps, and that causes the FBI to call Dr. King a notorious liar. But I think that U.S. ruling elite knew what it was doing when it was trying to get MLK and the civil rights leadership to stay away from people who have a worldview, because that's part of the ideological crisis. That's what I've just described in terms of people not seeing the significance of the Mexican election, for example, and what should be done in light of the fact that the Supreme Court can no longer be seen as a guarantor of rights. And then you see it as well with regard to some of the anti-Trump press, as it styles itself. I mean, from time to time, I tune into MSNBC, and you never know that the anti-Trump resistance is heavily dependent not only on the votes of black people, but votes of black women in particular, as evidenced by the election of Doug Jones to the U.S. Senate from Alabama just a few months ago. Because they hardly ever, I mean, you know, the dearth of black voices on MSNBC and CNN, it's just scandalous. And you can see what it reminds me of these magazines. You know, sometimes magazines decide, or it's just like these advertisers told the New York Post, well, we're not going to advertise in your newspaper because your readers are our shoplifters, for example. And you have magazines that decide they're going to fire a good deal of their circulation because they want a different kind of circulation. And so it's clear that MSNBC and CNN feel uncomfortable with the idea that they're in this anti-Trump coalition with black people. And so our voices are hardly ever found there. But obviously that's self-defeating, because given the fact that Trump has 90% approval rating in the Republican Party, given the fact that has happened for decades, the Republican Party has won 55-57% of the vote defined as white, including in 1991 when David Duke, a Klansman and a Nazi, won 55% of the Euro-American vote running for governor of Louisiana, given the fact that in Dixie, routinely, the right wing wins 9 out of 10 votes of those defined as white, and given the fact that you have people on the left who don't even realize this reality. I was just reading the New York Times this morning. Katha Pollitt of The Nation, one of our stalwarts, she's writing about the struggle against Kavanaugh and saying that there's this pro-choice majority. Now, she does not even deign to mention that 56% of women in 2016 defined as white voted for Trump, despite his being a confessed sexual predator and molester. Now, it's almost as if people don't want to deal with reality because it's too daunting. It's too painful. It's almost as if these facts that I've just mentioned don't fit their theory of the case. And so, therefore, they're like the mythical French intellectual who says, well, I know what you're saying is true in practice. The question is it true in theory? In other words, they're fixated on some sort of theory irrespective of what the facts say. And that's the roots of the ideological crisis. And, of course, I would argue that it goes back to their misestimation of the founding of this country, which they claim, even people on the left, was this great leap forward for humanity, when it actually was a great leap forward for slave owners. And once you make that fateful decision, which winds up rationalizing enslavement of Africans and rationalizing genocide against Native Americans and the illicit seizure of their land, well, once you can rationalize genocide, you can rationalize anything. So no wonder there's an ideological crisis in this country.
But we are being asked to believe that in the midst of this crisis, we do have significant movement, people switching their affiliations, if not, you know, on paper, but certainly in terms of their temperament. They are including African-Americans and Latinos. The Trump folks are saying there are more people of color with us than against us. And we're seeing also a kind of alienation from in terms of the duopoly, people walking away, at least mentally, from the Democratic Party. So do you think that's true? Do you think that that there is merit to that argument, that people are moving? They haven't made it clear yet, but in so many ways, they seem to be gravitating and blurring the lines.
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, Mr. Trump has picked up on the fact that the misinformed, confused rapper, designer Kanye West is apparently a fan of his, and maybe Kanye at the margins helps to attract a few other black people and other lost souls to the banner of the GOP. But as I see it, I think for years, the GOP, in light of the fact that U.S. imperialism had to make an agonized retreat from the more egregious aspects of white supremacy post-1954 because of international pressure, not least, therefore, they have to have this line about being non-racist. That's the line, even though everybody knows it's false. And so, therefore, it's very useful for them to flaunt the support of confused souls like Kanye West, for example. But I think it's more akin to a customer in a restaurant abusing the staff and other customers at surrounding tables feeling upset and embarrassed. That is to say, it's important for the GOP to be seen as not being overtly racist. Now, being practically racist is another story, because that might upset some of their voters who vote for them for tax cuts, for example. But then they go to church on Sunday and they find it difficult to rationalize voting for a Donald J. Trump while supposedly professing Christianity. So I would be very cautious about this idea of some sort of black and brown stampede to Mr. Trump, particularly in light of the scandal on the Texas-Mexico border, which I would like to think has certainly energized a good deal of the Latino population in Mexico, in the Rio Grande Valley, for example, in South Texas. You might be following the Senate race with Beto O'Rourke, the Democratic nominee against Ted Cruz, and Beto O'Rourke is winning all sorts of contests in terms of raising money. Now, he's still behind Ted Cruz, despite his having a fundraising advantage, believe it or not, which is quite remarkable in a conservative state like Texas. So I'd be very cautious about any idea of black and brown voters coming to the GOP banner. However, I would point you to an article that recently appeared in the Los Angeles Times after the early June primaries, which points to how the GOP in Orange County, just south of Los Angeles, might be able to survive by basically trying to recruit Vietnamese American representatives and Korean American representatives, many of whom are refugees from anti-communist refugees, and then running them as their nominees. Now, apparently that may gain some traction, at least in the short term, in Southern California, with regard to the GOP being able to hold on to certain congressional seats. And of course, as you know, if the Democrats win about 24 House seats in the November elections, they can take control of the House, which means taking control of spending and taxes, which means also perhaps an impeachment indictment against Mr. Trump. But even though that may be shaping up as good news for the GOP, this push into Asian America, I think it's going to have complications as relations with China get more complicated. And given the fact that the so-called white base of Trump has difficulty in distinguishing between and amongst Asians they should be opposed to and Asians that are in their corner, And even though we know that there are other complicating factors like the struggle in New York City over admission to Bronx High School of Science and Stuyvesant High School with Mayor de Blasio suggesting that there needs to be more Black and Latino students admitted to those schools, and many Asian American, particularly Chinese American, parents objecting, or even the struggle at Harvard University, where certain Asian Americans are claiming that they're being kept out unfairly from Harvard University. Although, one point I don't understand, perhaps somebody, one of your listeners can clarify this. I know that Xi Jinping's daughter, for example, went to Harvard University. So I don't, Xi Jinping, of course, is the president of China. So I don't think that these folks are claiming that even though the United States is in a new Cold War with China, that Harvard should be more accepting of the daughter of the president of China as opposed to a daughter of a Black sharecropper from Alabama. I mean, I'm sort of confused about all of this. But in any case, I think that as ever in the United States, what we have to be concerned about is the white right. What we have to be concerned about is white supremacy. And what we have to be concerned about is to what depths will the white supremacists sink in order to preserve their rapidly fading hegemony?
Well, this is a good place to wrap it up and say thank you so much for being with us today. It is always a revelation or a series of revelations when you are with us, and the way you take things apart and give us the historical analysis that supports your opinion. And I am so grateful that you are doing the work that you do, and I wish you the best in completing the assignments that you are undertaking at the moment. Thanks so much, Gerald, for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
All righty. And so we'll see each other tomorrow. Stay tuned. Keep it right here for Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. Bye-bye.